This article appeared in the winter 2009 issue of UU World magazine and is available online at uuworld.org. Forum: Religion and Science Can Be Partners, by Bruce Scheiman. Ever since the 18th century Enlightenment, which proclaimed the inexorable secularization of society, it has generally been assumed that the advance of scientific understanding would supersede religious authority based on unchallenged faith. Religion, presumably, belonged to the primitive past, while secular science and technology belonged to the mature future. Yet today, we see the flourishing of both. I have been a student of philosophy and theology for 30 years. I am also an atheist. In my book, An Atheist Defends Religion, Why Humanity is Better Off with Religion Than Without It, I explore the idea that on the deepest level, modern science and religion are not contradictory. They arise from the same urge toward progress, transcendence, and salvation found within the human spirit. The science and religion relationship model that dominates the modern cultural agenda is characterized by an irreconcilable conflict between extremists on both sides of the ideological spectrum: biblical literalists and creationists versus militant atheists and scientific materialists. Unfortunately, the vehemence of both sides only serves to perpetuate the conflict. On one side, we have a doctrine that uses the tools of science to deny the existence of God. As such, it is a rival belief system to theism that reaches beyond testable science. Science by itself is a method, not a creed. It is a way of formulating knowledge of the natural world. It is not a belief system, and thus not a refutation of anything outside the natural world. On the enduring mysteries of divinity, science remains officially agnostic. Yet when science is used by unbelievers to deny the divine, religious people see in science the negation of their most revered beliefs. On the other side are creationists and biblical literalists who use any ploy to introduce divine origins into the science curriculum of public schools. I am of the mind that only science should be taught in science classes, and that creationism is definitely not science. This is an unfortunate instance of religion encroaching upon science, which is no more justified than science encroaching upon religion. In the science-religion conflict model, the only way there can be a resolution among extremists is in defeat of the other side. The tragedy is that a polarized, competitive view debases both science and religion. Ultimately, when devout believers deny the Big Bang and evolution, this is not religion, it is ignorance. And when militant atheists claim that natural empiricism invalidates spiritual beliefs, this is not science, it is arrogance. In the spirit of reconciliation, the famous evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould developed the idea of respectful non-interference, whereby science and religion occupy distinct, non-overlapping magisteria, or domains. In Gould's model, science tries to document the factual character of the natural world and to develop theories that coordinate and explain these facts. Religion operates in the equally important but utterly different realm of human purposes, meanings, and values. Essentially, if the two disciplines never interact, there can never be any conflict. The problem with the non-overlapping paradigm is that religion and science are still seen as incompatible. This represents an agreement to disagree, to be civil, but ultimately not to take each other very seriously. And it suggests that there is no way for the two to relate to each other in any meaningful manner. In affirming science and religion as two distinct realms of knowledge, the non-overlapping model makes some very important pronouncements. Science cannot say with certainty that there is no spiritual world. What science discovers is not necessarily the whole of reality, and that should not cast doubt on what it does not discover. The success of science in its own domain does not negate other domains where its instruments are silent. Science cannot assign meaning or purpose to the world it explores. Questions about good and evil, about the meaning and purpose of existence, have no place in science because they cannot be addressed by the scientific method. An integration model goes one step further to acknowledge that science and religion are two dimensions of people's lives, and thus cannot be compartmentalized. It is plausible to think that science and religion can engage in a dialogue and can actually enhance one another to some extent, but the nature of that relationship depends on the person holding the beliefs. Religious scientists are inclined to see the language of God in the advancement of science. Francis Collins, head of the National Institutes of Health, used the term in reference to the Human Genome Project. Today, we are learning the language in which God created life. We are gaining ever more awe for the complexity, the beauty, and the wonder of God's most divine and sacred gift. It is possible for religious moderates to reconcile God and science, much the way Newton and other religious scientists did in previous centuries. These are people who say that scientific knowledge can strengthen faith in God, not eradicate it, because, like their scientific predecessors, it reveals the works of God through His creation. Collins is enthusiastic about this reconciliation of religion and science, but it is hugely unsatisfying to the non-believer. He is saying, "All we have to do is believe in God as the creator of the universe and evolution, and the issue is solved." While it is an admirable way for believers to reconcile religion and science, it is not a solution that non-believers can accept. To the chagrin of militant atheists, religion is not a vestige of an earlier phase of human development that would wither away as society became more secular and scientific. Religion is just as much a component of modern human life as is science, and there is no doubt that both science and religion are beneficial for humanity. What is characteristic of religion today is that, while it remains largely God-centered, it is increasingly human-centered. And while many religions still see people as creatures in relation to the Creator God, today, the nature of that relationship is more a partnership than one of unquestioned obedience. It can be claimed that science does not speak to ethics and values, but that is not entirely correct. The scientific method is truly values-neutral, dedicated only to understanding the natural world. The institution we call science, on the other hand, is motivated by a genuine desire to improve the human condition, increasing food yields, curing disease, overcoming the conditions that foster poverty, understanding the reasons for criminal behavior, distributing low-cost personal computers to poor children. The list of science's humanistic aims is endless. Thus, the two disciplines, science and religion, continue to express humanity's teleological quest for progress and perfection. The best and most complete form of goodness, in Aristotle's words. Science and religion come from the same human aspiration, the quest for transcendence and salvation. Both disciplines strive to understand the essence of the universe, the language of God, and in a sense, both seek to recover humankind's lost divinity. Through technological advancement, humans seek understanding of the universe and deliverance from our earthly existence. Science may tell us that nothing exists beyond the natural realm, but at the same time it seeks to push humanity above nature to omniscience, information technology, immortality, medical science, and omnipotence, mechanical, electrical, computer engineering. Thus, technology and the power of reason have come to be identified with progress and the perfectibility of humankind, a secular eschatology where human beings are liberated from their earthly limitations. The most salient commonality between science and religion is the drive to advance the human enterprise. Like religion, science promises a collective salvation of humanity. Both are devoted to the alleviation of human suffering and the advancement of humankind. The time has come to affirm science and religion as partners. Bruce Scheiman is a member of the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City and the author of An Atheist Defends Religion. Adapted with permission from An Atheist Defends Religion, Why Humanity is Better Off with Religion Than Without It. Copyright 2009 by Bruce Scheiman, published by Alpha Penguin Group USA. www.anatheistdefendsreligion.com. Bookshelf, Waiting for a Great Novel About UU Ministry, by Rosemary Bray McNatt. Looking for a surefire party buzzkill? Confess to the people around you that you're a minister. What was once a free-flowing, even outrageous conversation will come to a screeching halt, complete with apologies and a quick mental review by all present of every possible blasphemy uttered in front of you. This is often followed by an effort at deep, meaningful talk. The struggle between good and evil, the ultimate meaning of life, and assorted ethical dilemmas you specifically went to the party to avoid in the first place. Before I was ordained, I used to wonder why minister friends of mine often cautioned me not to mention the nature of their work. I thought at the time that they bore some secret, internalized embarrassment about their call. Now, nearly a decade after my own ordination, I'm guessing what they really wanted was a break from living with all the stories people make up about ministers, the fantasies and projections about who we are, how we live, what we think about, the private dreams we hold close. To be sure, some of us bring it on ourselves. One of the best descriptions I've ever seen about this in print comes from my UU colleague, the Reverend Aaliyah Kemmler, in the opening passage of her meditation, Too Close to Death. At a minister's retreat, someone read a passage about why ministers make people feel uncomfortable. It is because we dress in earth-colored clothes, and when we shake hands with people, we hold our hands a second too long and gaze into their faces and say earnestly, "How are you?" All the ministers in the room howled with laughter at the accuracy of this picture. But the passage went on to say that the real reason people find ministers weird and don't really want us to come to their parties, even if they invite us, is because we are too comfortable with death. From How We Are Called, a meditation anthology published by Skinner House Books. I don't disagree either with Kemmler or her source, but I also think some of the problem is that we think too much about life, often out loud. It's not that we mean to be so earnest and so serious every waking moment. It's just that if you are accustomed to encouraging yourself and others to see more than the obvious about the world, it's hard to stop viewing everything in that same frame. I learned this from my husband during the first month of my first settled ministry. Coming in from a long day of tough pastoral work, I flopped on the couch next to him and said in greeting, "So, how are things with your soul?" To his credit, Bob looked at me and replied, "You know, honey, most people come home from work and just say, 'Hi, maybe ask about the day.'" The stories people write about Unitarian Universalist ministers reflect the same levels of imbalance and confusion. To be sure, there are not many contemporary portraits of liberal religious ministers in fiction. Our living tradition has yet to produce our own Susan Howatch, the British writer who created the richly layered Starbridge series concerning the Church of England in the 20th century, nor Are we lucky enough to be blessed with steamy murder mysteries like those written by Julia Spencer Fleming? Her series of novels featuring the Reverend Claire Ferguson, a single Episcopal priest in an upstate New York hamlet, have been the highlight of many a summer's beach reading. Why is it that Anglicans have all the fun? While we wait for a more robust, realistic portrayal of a Unitarian Universalist minister, though, we can still have a pretty good time reading books from two authors, themselves UUs, with very different perspectives on the work of ministry. By far the more literary effort comes from Michelle Hunnevan in her 2004 novel Jamesland. The story, set outside Hollywood, California, in the community of Los Feliz, revolves around three primary characters. Pete Ross, a former chef and foodie now living with his mother, a nun, while recovering from significant mental illness. Alice Black, the great-great-granddaughter of psychologist William James, part-time bartender and unlikely mystic, and the Reverend Helen Harland, a Unitarian Universalist minister with an indifferent boyfriend and a supremely annoying congregation. Helen's only respite comes with her requisite summer off, spent in France with her boyfriend Louis, an administrator at a work farm for recovering alcoholics. Out of patience with Helen's critical flock, Lewis advises her to spend less time on theological readings and more time studying Machiavelli. As minister of the Morton Unitarian Universalist Church, Helen has already been told early and often that she is too spiritual, too earnest, too eager to change things. Helen diagnoses her congregation as stuck, attributing this to the unspoken grief felt by members after years of service by her predecessor, an old-school humanist with an eye for the ladies and a low tolerance for pastoral presence. But she won't give up on the people of Morton. Her goal is to draw in new members, build up her own constituency, and slowly, inexorably, dilute Morton's powers that be, namely an executive committee of elderly white men who had hired her, a woman fresh out of seminary, because they thought, correctly, it would seem, they could push her around, which they had her entire first year. Recovery and redemption are the themes of this wry and observant novel, the second for Hunnevan, who once aspired to the Unitarian Universalist ministry. She is a member of Neighborhood Unitarian Universalist Church in Pasadena, California. Her third novel, Blame, has just been published. These themes are supported by the ongoing subplot driven by Alice's Aunt Kate, who, between flights of hallucinogenic fancy and moments of genuine insight into her great-niece's restricted life, is writing a book about their ancestor, William James. The author is at her best in two arenas. She charts the wary, hesitant growth that both Pete and Alice undergo under Helen's benevolent gaze. Conversation after conversation, gourmet meal after gourmet meal, these two lost souls find their way back to wholeness in a storyline that is both edgy and tender. Secondly, Hunnevan has a genuine ear for the whiny, petulant UU congregant who confuses inherent worth and dignity with an unseemly sense of entitlement. She is even better when it comes to satirizing what passes for a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, as when Helen asks Pete what he thought after attending his first service. "I think you should find yourself a real big stick and go in swinging, instead of practically apologizing every step of the way."
"When did I apologize?"
"Each time you said, 'the overarching spirit that I choose to call God.'"
"Oh, that," said Helen. "I have to do that. If I say plain old God, they freak out and think I've gone Baptist on them."
And yet Helen has such boundary issues, it's hard to imagine her surviving the ministerial life. She is lonely and isolated to the point of foolishness, and thus finds herself desperate to make friends with Alice. This despite the fact that it is clear early on that Alice is likely to become a congregant. For ministers of my generation, that would have made Alice officially off-limits.
It's also pretty clear that Pete is developing a massive crush on Helen, and she is almost too kind in managing his expectations. I kept talking to the book and asking where Helen's colleagues were, or why every time her phone rang, another unhappy church member was on the line. James Lind is an enjoyable read by a skilled and graceful writer, but it's hard not to wonder how different this book would be if that grace and skill had been matched with the bittersweet, rather than merely bitter, experience of parish ministry. Emily Richards, by contrast, enjoys only one degree of separation from the ministerial life. Married to the Reverend Michael McGee, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Arlington, Virginia, Richards is the author of more than 60 books in a variety of genres. In her Ministry is Murder series of novels, Richards introduces us to the Reverend Edward Wilcox, minister of Consolidated Community Church in Emerald Springs, Ohio. More important than Ed, however, is Agate Sloan Wilcox, minister's wife and loving mother of two daughters, little Teddy and preteen Dina. It is through Aggie's eyes that we see the life of a liberal religious minister. Ed, she says, chooses to use his healthy intellect on questions like, why are we here? And my personal favorite, if salvation is only granted to a few, then why aren't the rest of us whooping it up? Unitarian Universalism is only a backdrop, however, for the requisite traditional mystery. In the first book of the series, Blessed is the Busybody, the church's women's society is set to visit their drafty parsonage. Ed is upstairs working on his sermon. Young Teddy is in the midst of conducting another cat funeral, attempting to work out for herself a theology of death. Dina is skulking about, already complaining about the forthcoming visitors, including Gelsey Fallowell, the president of the society and the bane of Ed's existence. Aggie is baking up a storm in preparation for her very important visitors. A series of hair-raising screams interrupts this cozy scene. Fearless Aggie opens her front door to find the body of a naked, dead woman, along with the two members of the Women's Society who found her first, including their nemesis. While they're waiting for the police, it's Gelsey who begins the interrogation. Who is this woman, and what was she doing dead on the parsonage steps? It turns out that Ed knows precisely who she was, a woman who had come to the church office a couple of times seeking his counsel. Unlike Helen in James Lind, however, Ed has clearly defined boundaries, even in the midst of a mystery, and gently ushers his nosy parishioners away. I'm sure the police will want statements from the three of you, Ed said, addressing the society board as he headed for the front door. Then I'm sure you'll be anxious to go home. Aggie will let you out the back way. These mysteries are well plotted and fun to read. Ed's service to Tri-C, as it's known, is the reason Aggie is living in Emerald Springs, but he's not really the focus of the four books in the series. Rather, he is the Unitarian Universalist minister as a vehicle that allows for small revelations about theology and ministerial life between scenes of domestic life or the insertion of a clue or two. By the second book, Let There Be Suspects, his UU identity has disappeared, and Ed plays a much more traditional role, that of exasperated husband hoping to convince his sleuthing wife to stay out of police business. It's not fair, really, to expect books like these to serve as recruiting tools for liberal religion or to say something profound about the nature of ministry. Genre mysteries aren't meant to say anything profound. That's why so many people read them. But as pleasurable as they are, none of these stories successfully captures the complexity, the ambivalence, the sorrow, or the satisfactions of parish ministry. The story that does still waits to be written. Books to Note by Christopher L. Walton. Frank Lloyd Wright's Unity Temple, A Good Time Place by Patrick F. Cannon. Photographs by James Caulfield. Pomegranate, 2009, 2495. This photographic tour of Unity Temple, the architectural masterpiece Frank Lloyd Wright designed in 1905 and 1906 for the congregation now known as Unity Temple Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Oak Park, Illinois, presents 49 color photographs of the building, along with Wright's architectural renderings and other archival images. An introductory essay examines how Wright's Unitarian background and the leadership of the Reverend Rodney Jehonnet, the congregation's minister during the design and construction of the building, influenced its innovative design. An appendix reprints the brochure published for the groundbreaking ceremony in 1906, which explains the plan and the theology it embodies. The Cathedral of the World, a Universalist Theology. Forest Church, Beacon, 2009-2495. After being diagnosed with cancer 3 years ago, the Reverend Dr. Forest Church completed 3 books, So Help Me God, His Masterful Study of Religious Politics in the Early American Republic, Love and Death, My Journey Through the Valley of the Shadow, A Pastoral Reflection on Living a Life Worth Dying For, and The Cathedral of the World, A Universalist Theology, published shortly after his death at age 61 this September. The Cathedral of the World brings together revised versions of essays and sermons written throughout Church's career as a minister, theologian, and leading interpreter of the Unitarian Universalist tradition. In 5 sections, he discusses God, American civil religion, religious dimensions of public issues, contemporary universalism, and the primal concerns of all religion, the mysteries of being alive and having to die. Church is entranced by the motto, E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one, which he explores both as an American civic ideal and as a religious insight. American civil religion helps people feel their kinship in national and ethical terms, but Church also affirms a more deeply religious, universal dimension to human interdependence. Each part, every individual, faith, color, and nationality is distinct, but one mother holds us all to her bosom, giving us life, providing us a home, the commonwealth of God. Church offers another version of this idea, drawing on our Unitarian and Universalist roots. Unitarianism proclaims that we spring from a single source, Universalism, that we share a common destiny. Church has been called the most important UU theologian of his generation, but none of these essays uses academic language. Instead, he expresses his theological insights as a preacher, using extended metaphors, aphorisms, and anecdotes to make his points. Some readers may wish that he had taken a more analytical approach, but in discussing criticism of Ralph Waldo Emerson, Church could just as easily be offering a defense of his own work. Mythic and parabolic language is imprecise. All Emerson could do was mirror his awe and humility in childlike reverence for the creation and his small yet consciousness-charged place in it. Church's religion invites people into a renewed sense of awe and gratitude for the gift of life and a deepened sense of responsibility for each other and for the world, his beloved cathedral. Christopher L. Walton is editor of UU World. Books by UU authors, by Sonia L. Cohen, Eric Furstman, and Jane Greer. Children and Parents. More Pocket Poems, selected by Bobby Katz, illustrated by Deborah Zemke, Dutton Children's Books, 2009-1799. Charmingly illustrated poems for every season. Katz is a member of the UU Congregation of the Catskills and has published many books for children, including, most recently, Pocket Poems, A Rumpus of Rhymes, A Book of Noisy Poems, and We the People. The Breastfeeding Mother's Guide to Making More Milk, Diana West and Lisa Marasco, McGraw-Hill, 2009-1795. The authors, both board-certified lactation consultants,
help mothers identify the cause of low milk supply and explore effective ways to create more milk and keep a milk supply going when away from the baby. West is a member of the Morristown, New Jersey Unitarian Fellowship. Something Happened, a book for children and parents who have experienced pregnancy loss. Kathy Blanford, illustrated by Phyllis Childers. SomethingHappenedBook.com, 2008, $12.95. Kathy Blanford, a children's grief counselor and member of the UU Church of Hinsdale, Illinois, has written a children's story about a boy who has lost a baby sister. Beautifully illustrated by Phyllis Childers, a member of the UU Church of Rockville, Maryland, the book contains text on each page advising parents on how to help children in the grieving process. Fiction and Nonfiction. Blame. Michelle Hunnevan, Sarah Crichton Books, 2009, $25. After killing two people in a drunk driving accident, Patsy McLemore, a history professor in her late 20s, must confront guilt, shame, and her alcoholism to find redemption. Hunnevan, a member of the Neighborhood UU Church of Pasadena, California, has published two previous novels, Round Rock and Jamesland, and has received a General Electric Foundation Award for Younger Writers and a Whiting Writers Award for Fiction. Sunday Meditations for Liberal Religious Worship, Peter Tufts Richardson, Red Barn Publishing, 2009-1995. Richardson, a retired UU minister, has assembled 65 of his meditations, which are accompanied by photographs he has taken at home and abroad. Arranged by season, the meditations deal with holidays, current events, nature, and the world's religions. Singing Meditation, Together in Sound and Silence. Ruthie Rosehour and Liz Hill, Skinner House, 2010, $12. An Introduction to Singing as Meditation, with two chapters about leading singing meditation groups. Rosehour, a member of the UU congregation of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, has led singing meditation groups since 2004. Hill is a member of Jefferson Unitarian Church in Golden, Colorado. We Side with the Morning, Daily Prayers to the God of Hope, William Clary, Sorin Books, 2009, 1595. Clary provides a prayer for each day on a different topic, allowing for a full spectrum of reflection on the nature of God. Clary is the author of numerous UU books, including ABCs for UU Newcomers. He is a member of the First UU Society of Burlington, Vermont. Shift. Change Your Words, Change Your World. Janet Smith Warfield. Word Sculptures Publishing, 2007, 1995. Warfield argues that a shift in consciousness can be created through a shift in words. She says that words are not truth. They are catalysts helping readers find their own truths. Warfield, who is an author, poet, attorney, and mediator, grew up in the Unitarian Church of Germantown in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and was a member of the UU Congregation of the South Jersey Shore in Absecon, New Jersey. Real Peace, Real Security, The Challenges of Global Citizenship, Sharon D. Welch, Fortress Press, 2008, $7. Just war theorists often focus on international conflict as the last resort. But here, Welch focuses on preemptive strategies that would avert war. Welch is provost and professor of religion and society at Meadville-Lombard Theological School in Chicago, as well as a member of the UU Church of Columbia, Missouri. Women Writing for a Change, A Guide for Creative Transformation, Mary Pierce Brosmer, Sorin Books, 2009, 1595. Brosmer founded Women Writing for a Change, a network of feminist writing schools to help women nurture the conscious feminine voice within them. Her book shares her techniques and the story of the organization, womenwriting.org.
Brosmer is a member of St. John's UU Church in Cincinnati, Ohio. A Guide to Fantasy Literature, Thoughts on Stories of Wonder and Enchantment, Philip Martin, Crick Hollow Books, 2009, 1695. Martin delves deeply into the genre of fantasy fiction in this revised edition of an earlier work, exploring the nature of the genre and different types of characters, settings, and plots. A member of the First Unitarian Society of Milwaukee, he is the series editor of The New Writer's Handbook, an anthology of advice about writing, and author of several books on the traditional culture of the Upper Midwest. Guided by Dreams, Breast Cancer, Dreams, and Transformation, Rachel G. Normant, Brandy Lane Publishers, 2006, 1695. Normant, an artist trained in dream interpretation and a member of the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Church in Charlottesville, Virginia, describes her own battle with breast cancer and how she used dreams to help chart her treatment. Hire the American Dream: How to Build Your Minimum Wage Workforce into a High-Performance, Customer-Focused Team. Dave Melton and Tim McIntyre. John Wiley and Sons, 2009, 2495. Melton shares the story of his success as the owner of four Domino's Pizza franchises in New York City. Chapters cover hiring, motivating minimum wage employees, customer service, and giving feedback. McIntyre is now Vice President of Communications for Domino's Pizza and a member of the UU Church of Farmington, Michigan. Compelling Conversations, Questions and Quotations on Timeless Topics, Eric H. Roth and Tony Aberson, Chimayo Press, 2008, 2450. This ESL textbook for advanced students is divided into sections called Your Life, Free Time, Modern Times, and Civic Life. Aberson, who has taught English and supervised English teachers for 35 years, is a member of the UU Fellowship of Wilmington, North Carolina. Her co-author, Roth, is her son. Sonia L. Cohen is assistant editor of UU World, and Jane Greer is senior editor. Unitarians Worked to Save Ute Indians, by Sonia L. Cohen. In 1870, President Ulysses S. Grant invited Protestant denominations to take over the management of American Indian reservations and agencies. His hope was that this move would cut down on reported government corruption while simultaneously helping to civilize the Indians. The American Unitarian Association, AUA, accepted charge of the district covering the Colorado Reservation occupied by various tribes of the Ute, consisting of about 8,000 people, a fact that had been almost entirely forgotten until recently. At the UUA's 2007 General Assembly, delegates called for the association and its member organizations to research their history and uncover our links and complicity with the genocide of Native peoples, with slavery and the slave-based economy, and with all types of racial, ethnic, and cultural oppression, past and present, toward the goal of accountability through acknowledgement, apology, repair, and reconciliation. The Reverend David Petty, the UUA's Director of Ministerial Credentialing, was thinking about the resolution and the General Assembly to be held in Utah in 2009 when he recalled a brief reference to the AUA Ute history in George Willis Cook's Unitarianism in America. Petty and Ted Fetter, board president of the UUA's Metropolitan New York District, began extensive research into the history. They found that four Unitarian ministers, John S. Littlefield, J. Nelson Trask, Edward H. Danforth, and Henry F. Bond, were assigned to work with the Utes on two agencies in the reservation, one at White River in the north and one at Los Pinos in the south. Their primary mission, as reported in the American Unitarian Association's 1877 yearbook, was to maintain a strictly honest administration of government affairs, and to meet the Indians in a humane, Christian spirit, saving them from trickery, robbery, intemperance, and other vices of frontier life, and to present to them the better phases of a Christian civilization. The Unitarians were, as Fetter described them during a 2009 GA workshop, largely failures in their efforts to bring the Utes into the dominant culture. Their actions were well-intentioned, but ultimately unwelcome and unproductive. They were ineffective, said Fetter. They didn't begin to understand the culture of the people they were working with. A succession of agents failed, he said, both in terms of government policy at the time and by participating in what we see in hindsight as cultural imperialism. But the serious trouble really started, Fetter said, when Danforth was replaced by Agent Nathan Meeker, not a Unitarian, who came to the White River Agency in 1878 with a utopian vision of turning the Indians into farmers. Despite documented evidence of poor farming conditions in the area, Meeker kept pushing the Utes to embrace agriculture. Initially, the Utes tolerated Meeker, but tensions eventually erupted and the military was sent out to handle the situation. A battle ensued, a number of people on both sides died, and Meeker was murdered. In response, Congress passed the Ute Removal Act, which in 1881 forcibly relocated the Utes to an eastern Utah reservation, far from the land with which they had felt spiritually connected. "It's a sad story," Fetter said, "and I believe the Unitarians had a part in it. Not as bad people, but as people who didn't know what to do to represent the interests of the Utes." During the opening worship service of GA 2009, UUA President William G. Sinkford offered a formal apology to the Utes on behalf of the association for past crimes against their people. "We participated, however ineptly, in a process that stole your land and forced a foreign way of life on you," he said. "We ask for your forgiveness, and we promise to stand with you as you chart your way forward." Forrest Cooch, a member of the Ute Indian Tribe and executive director of the Utah Division of Indian Affairs, and Ute Elder Clifford Duncan attended the worship service. Cooch accepted Singford's apology and welcomed the General Assembly to Utah, and Duncan offered a prayer in the Ute language. Sonia L. Cohen is assistant editor of UU World. UU World is the magazine of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. This recording is made possible by the UUA Department of Communications and the UUA Accessibilities Office. I'm Dick Hill. I'm an audiobook narrator, and my website is www.dickhill.com.